This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So what we proved to the Department of Defense with what was initially about a 5-gallon sample was that through a totally renewable process, that we could manufacture fuels that were chemically identical to the fuels that already worked in all of their ships and tanks and aircraft. And that was a big moment for us.
What's it like to see an idea grow into something bigger than you ever imagined? This week on Sea Change Radio, I sit down with entrepreneur Harrison Dillon, the co-founder of Solazyme, a biotech company that creates environmentally friendly synthetic designer oils that can be used in a wide array of products that have traditionally been petroleum-based. Dillon walks us through the evolution of an idea, from spitballing concepts in grad school to seeing Solazyme grow into a multi-million dollar publicly traded company. We also dive into the science behind this startup, look at the various technologies in the biofuel space, and discuss the emerging recognition of the role microbes can play in all sorts of new technologies. I was made to be that I never felt before. So I opened up my eyes and I took a look around. I saw you written across the sky. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my good friend Harrison Dillon. He's an entrepreneur and the co-founder of Solazyme. Harrison, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Great to be here.
So why don't you go back for us to your grad school days and tell us how Solazyme emerged. And also, I should mention from the get-go that you no longer actively work at Solazyme, so you're not speaking on behalf of the company.
Sure. So I actually became fascinated with genetics all the way back in boarding school, and went through college as a biology major and working in a lab. And that was my first experience in microbial genetics, was as an undergrad at Emory, learning how to clone genes out of bacteria. And then in grad school, I was doing my doctorate in genetics and had some ideas about how one could use genetics not for human health, which was the focus in the mid-90s as the Human Genome Project was ramping up, but how to use genetics for other things, industrial things, and in particular, renewable energy was really interesting to me. And so some of the original ideas around Solazyme involved how one could use genetics to engineer microbes that make stuff that's flammable to make things like biofuels very efficiently and cost-effectively. And algae ended up looking like the platform that we wanted to use. And after grad school, I became a patent attorney, moved to Silicon Valley, and eventually started the company with a co-founder in a garage about 12 years ago, and built the company from there.
And what is the company for listeners who aren't familiar with Solazyme?
Solazyme is an industrial biotechnology company that uses microalgae to manufacture a whole suite of products ranging from designer renewable oils to food products to cosmetics even. There's a whole cosmetic line called Alginist that's in several thousand Sephora stores across the world. So what we did at Solazyme was build a platform that could commercialize algae manufactured through large-scale fermentation, and the products have gone into a lot of different sectors. And I was there about 10 years and left about a year and a half ago after a decade of building the company, and have sort of taken a breather and gotten into some new things as well.
I want to get into that maybe in a separate discussion, but walk us back to those early days a little bit more, if you will, beyond the whole raising money through venture capital and pitching people on the idea. What was it like to go from whiteboard to seeing it into a finished product?
Well, it's very satisfying to see these products on the market. And you can really appreciate how much work it took to get those things on the market when you've been working on them for years and years, really at first as a concept and then as a prototype, and then you make more and more changes along the way, and finally it finds its home as a product on the shelf. And really, I think that experience, it was very impactful in that when I walk into a store today or I see any kind of finished product today that's sitting there taking up space, getting bought by people and performing a use for people that they're willing to pay for, I really have full appreciation for how much work it took to get it there, because, you know, we buy things every day and don't think that much about what it took to get these products to the stage where we're buying them. But it is a long, difficult, trying process.
So there's probably several light bulb moments that you can look back and think about. Why don't you try to highlight for our listeners a few of them from when you and your partner, Jonathan, had this idea and were like, we're going to do this, to a few of these moments along the way where it was actually happening.
I can give you a few examples. One is that we were originally focused on using algae to manufacture hydrogen gas. That was really the first thing that we tried. And
that would be used for?
That would be used mainly as a fuel, but also to generate electricity. And what we realized as we really started working out the details for how we were going to get there, we realized that hydrogen as a fuel has basically no infrastructure available to support it. So there are no hydrogen gas stations to speak of. There are, you know, fuel cell cars are really just experimental. There were no distribution networks. And even if we could have made hydrogen at a very low price, there just wasn't the infrastructure to support the use of it.
Yeah, it's really outlined very clearly in Who Killed the Electric Car? They have a whole piece on what about hydrogen, and they kind of show you why it didn't really take off.
Right, right.
Or so hasn't yet, at least.
That was something that we abandoned pretty early on. And then we started making oil using algae, which is another thing that algae can make. And we were originally thinking of ourselves just as a biofuel company. But a pretty big aha moment for us came when we realized that we shouldn't think of ourselves as a fuel company, because fuel wasn't really what we made. What we made was oil. And what we had developed is a process for designing the oil to be ideal for each product you want to make, whether it's a bar of soap or a lubricant or a biofuel or a cooking oil. Oils are there are many, many different types of oil, and we had a custom process for designing oils. And we decided that really what we were was a designer oil company who could make things that go into any product made from oil and not a biofuel company.
So surfactants for cleaning and those kind of other?
On and on and on. Industrial lubricants, plastic materials, just tons of different applications for the technology. And once we stopped thinking of ourselves as a biofuel company and really as a designer oil company, it forced a change in the way we were going to market that was pretty big for us.
Talk about the laboratory process and the actual physical challenges that you and your colleagues faced starting up.
You know, I still remember when we made our very first sample of oil. It was a Herculean effort, and it took, I don't know, a couple of months, and we ended up with maybe a milliliter or two of oil. So it was a very inefficient process. We were growing the oil in a pond.
You mean growing algae in a pond?
We were growing algae in a pond, which is not a very optimal process. And then extracting the oil out of the algae, and it was just a very difficult process. And the amount of oil we got was just tiny. And another big change that we made along the way was we switched our manufacturing method from growing the algae in a pond to growing the algae in a fermenter, which are really two fundamentally different ways to grow the algae. And what we discovered is that the cost of making the oil through fermentation was orders of magnitude lower than from growing the algae in an outdoor pond.
My heart is always on the line. I've traveled all kinds of places. The song is always the same. Got lonesome fuel for fire. Got 45s to play at night. Got books to spend with every weekend. The story's always the same. Got lonesome fuel for fire.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the co-founder of Solazyme, Harrison Dillon. So you have that first little milliliter or two of oil. What's the next hurdle of producing something that you could then show investors?
Well, I remember a meeting at one of the oil majors, where we walked in with a liter of oil. This was probably a year after we had made the tiny sample. And we, for dramatic effect, we had the bottle of oil sitting on the conference room table at the oil company. And
sorry to interrupt, but the reason for this meeting was you wanted them to potentially invest in the company?
We wanted them to partner with us on the research as well as invest in the company. And you know, the first thing they told us is sometimes people walk in here with a jar of soy sauce, and so we need to see if you guys are for real.
Oh, they didn't believe you.
Apparently, some people have walked in there with soy sauce before. But you know, we sold them a sample, and then I'd say a really big moment for us was when we started doing business with the U.S. Military, who has a strategic interest in alternatives to petroleum, but they want not only alternatives to petroleum, but they want the same exact fuel. And so what we proved to the Department of Defense with what was initially about a 5-gallon sample was that through a totally renewable process that we could manufacture fuels that were chemically identical to the fuels that already worked in all of their ships and tanks and aircraft. And that was a big moment for us because we really proved to them that we could make fuels that were drop-in compatible with all of their hardware. And that was the beginning of a good working relationship we had with the military.
With plunging oil prices over the last year, Harrison, a lot of these companies in the alternative fuels or alternative oil product segments have scaled back on trying to compete with the ExxonMobils of the world. Where do you see their niche? Or where are these companies placing their bets?
So using industrial biotechnology, fermentation technologies with microbes, you can make many different molecules that have a lot of different uses in various sectors, from fuels to chemicals to materials and foods, and it goes on and on. Fuels is a sector where you have to make the material at the very highest volumes that anything is made on Earth, and you're typically operating at pretty low margins. So fuel tends to be sort of farther out than a lot of other sectors where companies that use these types of technologies can go. So for example, in specialty chemicals, the margins are better. You can get higher prices for the materials. In food products, these are higher value materials. And so I think what people have learned over the years in developing these technologies is that It's hard to go after fuel right out of the gate, and that going after smaller volume, higher margin materials is a strategy that not only makes sense, it sort of may be the only way to get there. And you know, when you look at the petroleum industry and the volumes that these companies are producing, they're absolutely enormous. But you also have to remember that this is an industry that's more than 100 years old, and the amount of investment that's gone in is staggering. So it's hard to compete on a very short timeline with what these companies have been making for decades and decades and decades.
So Harrison, let's get into the science of it. The microbial genetics were what attracted you to the industry. Anybody who's heard a State of the Union speech from George Bush through Barack Obama has heard cellulosic fuel, wood chips, sugar, cane, algae. What's succeeding in the industry, and what's kind of becoming prohibitively expensive? Where are the trends going in terms of what's known as feedstocks?
The use of cellulosic feedstocks has been more challenging than people have realized earlier on. And it's just a nut that's very hard to crack, and people just haven't quite gotten there yet, which is it's unfortunate, because cellulosic material is available at very, very large quantities. When you look at the amount of plant material that's not food, that's produced as, you know, a waste product or is just generally available, it's huge amounts of material. But the process to turn that raw material into usable fermentable sugar that microbes can metabolize and turn into useful molecules, the price of that conversion process has really been prohibitive. And
at scale that we're talking about.
Right? That's right. That's right. And there are some facilities that are using cellulosic materials that are operational now, but it's not very many, and whether or not those are profitable, I think, is an open question right now. So the cellulosic stuff has been, I think, just a lot harder than people had initially realized. But what you can do with technologies that effectively convert more simple and pure forms of sugar is develop the technologies today on simpler sugars that are more purified, and then convert those to cellulosics as the cellulosic technology becomes available over time.
When we're talking about algae fuel, what does that mean? There's lots of different ways to grow algae and to cultivate it into a feedstock for fuel or oil products. Why don't you give us some of the different areas where that science has been explored?
There are two fundamentally different ways to grow algae. One is called autotrophic growth, which means growing the algae in a pond or in what's called a photobioreactor, which is an enclosed apparatus that allows light to come in. And those autotrophic methods use sunlight as the sole energy source to feed the algae. The other method, and this is the one that Solazyme uses, is called heterotrophic growth. And that's a fermentation process where the algae are consuming sugar as a feedstock. So they're growing in the dark, not using any light as an energy source, solely using sugar as an energy source. And in the former, the autotrophic process, that's a process where only light is used as an input. And so the algae are directly converting photons into chemical energy. And then from there, they can turn that chemical energy into molecules such as oil. In a heterotrophic process, plants such as sugarcane are converting solar energy into chemical energy in the form of sugar. And then that sugar is then fed to the algae in a large steel fermentation tank that's where the growth is occurring completely in the dark. And in Solazyme's experience, and I think, frankly, the experience of most people out there, or I'd say pretty much anybody who's really done the comparison, the cost of manufacturing oil from algae using a fermentation process is far, far cheaper than the cost of manufacturing oil using an autotrophic process.
Listen, if you're ever in need, ain't no limit to what I'll do. I'll work 8 days a week and give it all to you. Cause that's what love will do for you. That's what love will make you do. No matter how hard I fight it, oh, I'm still in love with you. Fine.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the co-founder of Solazyme, entrepreneur Harrison Dillon. So, Harrison, I know you don't speak for Solazyme here, but how has the increased production of ethanol over the last decade or so affected the alternative fuel industry in your estimation? Has it been a positive or has it detracted from the bottom line of the synthetic fuel space?
I would say the effect of ethanol is mixed because on the positive side, ethanol is a fuel that works in cars today. It works in up to about 10% in existing engines. If you want to blend it at higher levels than 10%, you have to do some changes to the design of the engines. But it's proven that biofuels can work out in the world today in engines that exist today. And in Brazil, for example, sugarcane ethanol is quite cost effective and has a very low carbon footprint. On the not so good side, ethanol, it's as a molecule, it's just not a great fuel. So it's lower energy density. It's not infrastructure compatible in that above 10% blends, you need to start using different types of engines. It picks up water from the environment. So pipelining it is very difficult. You can't just use standard pipelines. And so ethanol, and then depending on how you manufacture the ethanol, it may actually have a carbon footprint that's no different from petroleum.
I've heard that before. Why is that? Why is the carbon footprint so high? Is it because of the conversion process?
The carbon footprint of ethanol can be very high depending on the source of sugar as well as the source of electricity that's going into the plant. So if it's Brazilian sugarcane ethanol, the sugar is produced at a very low carbon footprint. The sugarcane is really efficient and it doesn't require tons of fertilizer, tons of diesel fuel to produce the sugar cane.
Is that because sugar grows easier in Brazil?
Sugar cane is just an incredibly productive crop, and Brazil has a great climate for it. On top of that, you need energy, quite a bit of energy, to run the fermentation process and also run the distillation process, where you're heating up everything to distill away the ethanol. You need a lot of energy to do that. And in Brazil, that energy comes from the bagasse, which is the leftover sugarcane stalks. So it's completely renewable, all that electricity. If you take a totally different scenario, using, say, corn that's grown in the continental United States, that corn uses a lot more fertilizer and fuel to manufacture than sugarcane in Brazil. And on top of that, it's common that in the Midwestern U.S., the electricity that's going into the plant to run the fermentation and distillation, that electricity is coming from coal-fired power plants. So when you have that, you have a very different crop that uses a lot more energy to produce, and then a different electrical source, you can get dramatically different carbon footprints for these 2 gallons of ethanol that are chemically indistinguishable at the end of the manufacturing process. It's a bit like taking a Tesla, right? If you take a Tesla and you're running it in the Pacific Northwest where it's mostly hydropower, that Tesla is pretty clean. If you're running that Tesla in, in Ohio where it's mostly coal-fired power, the Tesla's filthy. Same car, totally different footprint.
What do you find to be some of the most exciting developments in other areas of microbial science, Harrison?
I've found microbes fascinating for a long time. There are archaebacteria that are some of the most ancient organisms on Earth that are embedded within coal. So they've been in the Earth's crust in coal for billion years plus. And for example, some of these microbes sit there, 5 miles underground. They've been there forever, and they're eating the coal and releasing methane. And so some of the coal bed methane that we get is actually the product of archaebacteria metabolizing the coal miles and miles underground. They've been there forever. So I'm fascinated by what microbes can do.
Just in digestion alone, it seems like there's been a lot of findings. Just in our own bodies, there's microbes that we still haven't even begun to understand.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up. So there's a whole new field called microbiome science, where people are looking at the collection of microbes that are colonizing and operating environments everywhere, including your own body. And some people have been studying, for example, the microbiome of the human gut. So that's kind of a hot area right now, where people are looking at the microbes that have colonized the human gut and how that collection of microbes changes based on someone's diet, based on where they live, based on the different buildings that they're in. And it can change dramatically if you do something like take an antibiotic, for example. That'll totally clear out a lot of the microbes in your gut. And then they, it gets recolonized by mainly by the food that you eat, but also by the air that you breathe and everything and everyone that you come into contact with. And our ability to understand the microbiome has really been facilitated in large part by the amazing drop in the cost of DNA sequencing that's happened over the last 20 years. So in the last 10 years, the cost of DNA sequencing has dropped about a millionfold. So you could have looked at all this stuff a long time ago. It just wasn't very cost effective. But now, with the advances in sequencing and these incredibly high throughput machines, you can get a huge amount of genetic information about the microbes that are in any environment, whether it's inside a person's gut or on the seafood that's sitting there in the store that you're going to buy, or the microbes that are in the soil in a field that's growing a crop like corn or soybeans, or even the microbes that have colonized the ventilation shaft of a building and maybe giving us asthma or allergies. When you look at the sort of long view of our relationship with microbes, it's amazing that over 90% of the cells in the human body are microbial. It just shows that we co-evolved with these organisms, that they're not there by accident. It's a symbiotic relationship. We have up to 1,200 species of microbes in our sinuses alone. So we really evolved with microbes, and they are part of who we are. And the technologies for sequencing microbes and analyzing how they colonize different environments, I think, is really opening up a lot of new interesting areas for us.
Harrison Dillon, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Great to be here, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Steve Earle, M. Ward, and Little Milton.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability.
For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.